Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you're listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us playwright, performer, and author Sarah Playdell. She's a graduate of Oxford and London Universities, an award-winning writer, performer, playwright who teaches English and writing at the University of Maryland. For the past 20 years, she's been a master teacher, artist, and arts integration specialist, working with institutions that include the Wolf Trapp Institute for Early Learning Through the Arts, the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, and the Luce Institute. In 2000, she won the American Association for Theater Educators Award for Best Book of the Year. And today, Sarah, thank you so much for being with us to talk about your debut novel, Cologne.
It's a pleasure.
I am so excited to talk to you about it, having just read it very recently and having still moments where I am under its spell. I want to read for our listeners the short publisher's description of your book. London, 1960. Renate von Hasselmann, a 19-year-old German au pair, arrives at Victoria Station prepared to meet her new charges, Carolyn and Maggie Whittaker. Yet she is ill-prepared for their parents. The mother, Helen, knows more about Nazi Germany than Renate does, and the father, Jack, disarms her with his quicksilver charm. In Sarah Playdell's debut novel, Cologne, from Fuse Publishing, childhood and history collide, blurring the distinctions between victim and victor, ruin and redemption. With delicate humor, Playdell presents a portrait of a family on the cusp of great social change, while reminding us that the traumas of war revisit the children of the peace. So here we are in 1960, and these children, these two sisters, are how old?
They are 11 and 8.
Okay, so one is on the cusp of teenagedom,
yeah.
And the other one is an elementary school age child. And they have this 19-year-old German au pair, and they know so much of the feelings post-war from their mother in particular, right?
They know a lot. They have a lot of information, and my sort of focus became on how they process that information, what is conscious, sort of verbal, what sort of remains almost, you know, bodily, sensational. They know it sort of physically in the way that they act out this knowledge in games and in sort of symbolic play, really, that plays the place that sort of bridges what they know consciously and what is still buried just sort of in their DNA.
So were you raised in London during those years yourself?
I was. And actually it was living here and becoming quite nostalgic about the Britain of my childhood and sort of dwelling on it and sort of feeling a lot of nostalgia that sort of started me dreaming about this particular novel and the themes. Because obviously I grew up in the aftermath of World War II with all those sort of quote-unquote, you know, victorious survivors. And I began to think about what it meant to have won a war that cost you so much.
And how did you develop the idea of using these sisters as a pivotal way of discussing that?
Well, initially, I was going to write about a brother and a sister. The older sibling, Caro, was going to be Colin, a boy. I realized his voice, it wasn't quite a boy's voice. It was knowing. But the way that he felt to me, he just became Caroline. And then there was Maggie.
Do you feel that you identify with one of the sisters more than the other?
I have a sister. She is 3 years younger than I am, just like Caroline and Maggie. But we were not as close. We actually were quite distant growing up, so we didn't spend as much time together as these two do. And I think our personalities are different.
But you both shared that growing up post-war.
We both very much shared that growing up. And my sister is still in England and I'm here. And it's interesting how for her, it's just a continuum. I mean, that was England in the 50s and 60s and it's just kept on moving. Whereas for me, it's kind of stuck, frozen in the past, almost kind of like an ice sculpture. I get very sentimental about it. And that it was the sentiment, really, the kind of the nostalgia that got me going on this book.
Ultimately, it's
right.
About a very serious topic, the traumas of war. Do you talk about that often when you're talking about the novel?
Yes, I do, actually. There is childhood sexual abuse in it, very much from the child's knowledge which is a fragmented knowledge, because I think people write about childhood sexual abuse in a way that is almost outside the way that children actually live and experience it. You experience it in fragments and as this mysterious intrusion on your mind, not as an event. It's there, you know, towards the end of the novel, and I think I portrayed it more subtly than some people expected me to. But I wanted to make it as close as possible to a child's experience and a child's memory. Children's memory of abuse is very complex and very multiple.
You absolutely achieved that, in my opinion. When I got to the end, I thought at once, oh, I expected that, and oh, this happened. How is that connected, do you think, to the times and the post-war time?
What surprised me is thinking about the character of Jack, who reminded me of my own father, but of other men I knew. And I've seen, every time I sort of look on television or, you know, but something around that period, there were an awful lot of men like that who came out of that post-war period. Those kind of men who in empty suits. I don't want to just sort of dump on men, but there were a lot of people who were carrying around these personae that they had sort of pulled together out at the end of the war, and they were sort of the walking wounded because they had been through so much and lived in a time where they were supposed to carry on, particularly those who'd won. And so I think a lot of their unprocessed pain from the public arena, from, you know, the battlefield, from war, both at home and abroad, came home. They brought it home with them, and it got sort of passed on to the children. I mean, Jack's an alcoholic, and his pain just, in a way, pours right through him. He has really no self-knowledge whatsoever. His wife, Helen, has more, but she's still just as traumatized.
Right. And the interesting twist with Helen is that she's got a connection to the German family whose daughter is their au pair. So
exactly.
Can you explore that a little bit with us?
Well, I sort of set Helen, Jack calls her Grace, and that's sort of part of his grandiosity. I set Helen up as a character who was more, I wanted to make her a little more complex than the sort of average British woman of that time period, who had actually survived something like the Blitz and lived through the bombings in London. She had had a prior connection with Germany as a teenager and had fallen in love with the culture and sort of seen the value of many, many Germans as wonderful human beings and actually fallen in love with a young German, but then came home and was part of the war effort. She struggled to reconcile the sort of the jingoism of Britain after the war. I mean, the hatred of the Germans. I mean, these awful little rhymes about Hitler and, you know, bad Jerrys, and I can go on and on. They're all the books full of them. The bashing up the Nazis, cutting up Nazis was the favorite play activity of most children. I mean, not, you know, playing with German soldiers and sort of imprisoning them and doing nasty things to them. But she had a very mixed feeling about the Germans because she had this very powerful experience with the von Hasselmann family before the war. She brings this au pair back to her home from the family that she had been in before the war. It's the sort of baby daughter of the German family that she'd stayed with. And she has a lot of sympathy, almost empathy, for what they must have gone through and wants to sort of give back. But it comes across hard to both the culture as a whole, the Brits, I mean, they didn't want to see any Germans at all, and to the little girls, because as children, you want things black and white. You want to know what's good and what's bad. And in the children's eyes, you know, the Brits were good and the Germans were bad. So they had a very hard time with the sort of ambiguity, the nuance of their mother's impulse, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And what happens to the 19-year-old au pair when she's sent abroad to England?
Well, she comes abroad, she's sent by her mother, who has this sentimental attachment to Helen, because Helen had, you know, lived in her home and been in love with her son. So Renata is sent unwillingly. She doesn't really want to come to England. And she'd much rather go to America. She's had a rough time. She was a young girl during, you know, a very young child during the war. She feels that she's not responsible for what happened, and why should she be? And that she's being sent to this country that will look down on her. And she's angry about it and really wishes that, you know, she were elsewhere. So she comes with her with a lot of rage, actually, against Helen. She finds Helen's attitude towards her patronizing, and Helen's desire to talk about the pre-war years in Germany more than she can tolerate. And a very sort of acrimonious relationship develops between Helen and Renata. Much to Helen's disappointment, Helen expects, you know, there to be this great warmth and gratitude, and it's not there.
So I am aware that I was saying her name wrong. It's Renata.
Renata,
right?
Yeah.
It's interesting to say and hear things aloud after you've created a sound in your mind from reading it. There's so much complexity here in the characters. So Helen has the backstory of having fallen in love with a young man in Germany.
Yeah, Renata's older brother.
Yeah.
Much older brother, yeah.
Right, so she doesn't really remember. The 19-year-old
no.
doesn't really remember that. Jack's post-war alcoholism and lostness, although he hides it with charm. And a lot of deception underneath that charm. And then these
yeah.
two little girls growing up in the 50s and taking what they can from, like all children do, from their parents' stories and also from television. So tell us about 1950s London as these girls experience it.
Well, I remember it very well. It was the beginning of a lot of, you know, the signature British television, the kind of humor, the Harry Secombe and Spike Milligan. It was the music just before the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles weren't there yet, but it was Cliff Richards, and it was beginning of British rock and roll, which is really different from American music. Caroline, towards the end, is just beginning to look at, you know, be sort of taken in by swinging London. It was just beginning. The short skirts and Bieber, the clothes shop, that style was just coming in. Meanwhile, what was going out was that very sort of proper 50s British sort of demeanor with women in, you know, very sharp suits, a very sort of proper manner. Mind you, this was a group of women, a culture that had, you know, suffered rationing way into the 50s. So the food was disgusting. So I remember it. Food that was made to taste good, but really the ingredients were pretty minimal. So you had things like pink blancmange that wobbled and fish fingers that hardly had any fish in them and lots of bread and butter. So it was this sort of culture of deprivation and propriety that was sort of slowly evolving into the beginning of what would be the British version of the Cultural Revolution.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 Port Townsend. In case you've just joined us, you're listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, Sheila is talking with Maryland playwright, performer, and novelist Sarah Playdell.
I do remember that Helen, the girl's mom, seems to have a secret, partially secret stash of candy that they're
yes,
happy to
black
eat.
Like magic.
Right, right. It is nostalgic. I was raised in New Jersey in the 50s.
Yeah.
We didn't nearly have it as hard as people in Europe. But, you know, the sense of conservation, the sense of
That's
things
right.
being special, not like you could
yeah.
just walk into the corner Starbucks and get some sugary treat just like that
right.
three times a day. Yeah. It was so different.
Yeah. That was very much my experience as a child. I mean, we were allowed to have what we called sweeties once a week, and we kept them in a tin.
Once a week.
Yeah.
So these little girls, how long was their au pair Renata in their lives?
Well, I run the book through a year. I decide she arrives in February, and she's gone by the end of the year. I thought that to do it through one rotation of seasons was an apt literary device because it's a short book.
But the impact of that year on them, if you imagine it into the future, is very large.
Oh, it's, yeah, it completely changes everything because she undoes everything. I mean, the father starts to flirt with her as he flirts with everyone. And because of her, sort of the, she almost has her vendetta against Helen. She's going to get Helen back for this sort of patronizing attitude that she has. And she's almost as if she's trying to take it out on Helen. So she responds. And this sort of subterranean affair starts happening between Renata and Jack. And in a sense, Renata wins. She kind of undoes him and undoes the family. And by the time she walks out, the family's in tatters. And I don't want to give away the ending, but right. It's really broken.
Right. And that's part of the spell that's cast. And besides the fabulous details of life at the Times, it's just one of those books that has stayed with me. And I find myself thinking about it during the day. And I'll think about my past and I'll think about those girls. And I really enjoy when a book does that for me. So maybe this is a good time for us to hear a little excerpt from the book.
Okay. Well, as I said, a lot of the book is about the girls playing. And they play games that have resonance with the war. The part I'm going to read has got some resonance with, has poppies in it. Well, you know, Flanders Field and World War One. They've no idea about that. And they're always playing Spitfires and Paratroopers and the Maginot Line. And so their play is sort of fun. And I enjoyed sort of creating all of that, all their sort of their back and forth. That's part play, part spite. But the part I'm going to read from is when they're at the seaside and Helen is pregnant. And being British, she hasn't told anybody. But the girls have a sense that something's not quite right with their mum. And she comes home from the beach and she goes upstairs to lie down. And Caroline decides she's going to eavesdrop on her mum and listen to the conversation between her mum and her dad. And the section I'm going to read starts with when that happens. "What's wrong with Mummy?" Maggie asks over and over after her mother's withdrawn to the bedroom with the door closed and the blinds pulled shut to keep out the remains of the sun. "What's wrong with Mummy?" "Christ, will somebody turn off that bloody broken record?" Jack Whittaker yells. It dawns on Caroline that her father is a hair's breadth from striking her sister. And although she finds Maggie as infuriating as he does, she's compelled to intervene. It's a compulsion that will drive her all her life, undo her and remake her, but never let her go. "Mummy probably has a touch of sunstroke, that's all," she chirps with affected cheeriness. "Come on, Maggie, let's go and pick a nosegay for Mummy." But Caroline waits a while, skulking behind the hydrangea at the front door. Woman trouble. Could that be the same thing as getting your knickers in a twist? The heavy, scentless heads of the hydrangeas knock against her cheeks. Like ladies' bottoms, she thinks. These hydrangeas are pink, not blue. Too much acid in the soil, she tells herself, as she creeps back indoors and climbs the solid oak stairs with their lacquered banisters and rosewood spindles. A toilet flushes. Her father's footsteps echo within the room. It's comforting to think he's come upstairs to check on her mother. "Calm down, old girl, calm down." "Calm down? How dare you then, suggesting that mafioso down to keep me calm? You know full well he's the last person I want to see. I need to intervene here that Jack is bringing down his chauffeur to purportedly drive Helen to the hospital, but he's actually bringing him down, so he's got a drinking companion. Just in case of what? An unforeseen emergency. Come on, Grace, no use getting worked up. I'm taking every precaution. Besides, Mario's not in the mafia. He's a chauffeur, darling. Plain and simple. A motor car mechanic on the side, and he's Spanish, not Italian. Even worse, says Helen. At least the other fascists have been rounded up and hung. Have you seen the images on his belt? I don't know how he gets away with it, unless the London's establishment is full of fascist sympathizers after the war as it was before. Calm down, old girl, This is hardly a time for politics. Caroline's father's voice is plangent and tender. Another pause. She wishes these pauses would extend on and on forever, like the sea. In fact, she wishes that if indeed she had to admit she's been eavesdropping on her parents' conversation, she could claim all she was eavesdropping on was their silence. She wishes they were both asleep so she could imagine them curled in one another's arms. Her mother, the inscrutable knot, her father, and only her father could resolve.
Thank you, Sarah. I can hear your performer background in your wonderful reading, and I really enjoyed it. I feel like I'm watching the play of this as well as when I read it, being in their room or identifying with the older girl who's eavesdropping. Thank you so much. That excerpt really gives us the flavor of this household.
You're welcome.
And I'm thinking as I listened and reviewed what we had been talking about earlier, that the work you do currently with integrating the arts into children's education seems to me to be of a piece with your interest in these two siblings and your nostalgia for your background. So could you tell us a little bit about the work you do with children?
Well, I'm obviously interested in the way children play out their knowledge, you know, not just their traumas, but how they work out the traumas that they have experienced and how they acquire new knowledge and how important play is and how acting out stories is to that process. So I've done a lot of work developing process drama with children so they can learn through storytelling and living through the stories in a way that's not just speaking the story.
So how do you do that? How does that look? What is the child doing during this?
Well, if you take a story like Where the Wild Things Are, you would have the teacher be the mother coming in and addressing all the children as though they were Max, who've been being wolfish downstairs in the garden. And she and all the children as Max would have a conversation about what had been going on in the garden and how Max's behavior had got out of control. She would end up putting all these little Maxes to bed without their supper, and then would turn back into the teacher, and the teacher would talk to all the children who were pretending, who now felt like Max, who'd been put to bed without his supper, and talk about how they, what they were feeling about it, what was it like to have their mother be angry with them, what was it like to know that they'd upset their sister, and really talk about their feelings. And I would give them a little lemon juice so they knew that sometimes when you're feeling sour, it's almost a sourness is a sad taste. So they would experience some of the difficult feelings that they were having. And then how could we turn those sour feelings into a sweet taste? And I'd give them a little honey. And I'd sort of guide them through the way that in the book, Max uses his imagination to take himself on a journey that heals the hurt of being reprimanded by his mum, but at the same time helps him sort of come back to a place that's more regulated and sort of calmer.
That's fabulous. I wish I could be in that classroom. I mean, it's just what we want literature to do, and to guide children in participating in that way and learning.
And we go on a great boat journey. I create a parachute with a rope boat swing inside and a sail and sailing music, and we sail off to the land of the wild things and jump on bubble wrap and become into wild thing rumpus. And
I want to come to your classroom.
It's fun.
Yes.
The whole point is for the kids to have a load of fun, right. Partly in a story like that where they have started off with something quite difficult, which is a parent punishing them or cautioning them for some behavior that has got out of hand. So it's good to sort of, you know, to make the drama something that really extends the emotional life of a difficult experience.
Absolutely. And I see that those kinds of interludes in your novel. The two girls don't always get along at all, and there's a lot of rivalry and dislike. But then they do these things like have a special overpass that where they make incredibly loud shouts underneath, and different kinds of ways they come together in play that I think is quite healing for them.
Yeah, like after the passage that I read, they go out and they go hunting wasps and collecting wasps to turn into pets, and then they discover that wasps probably aren't the best kind of pet to have.
I do have to ask you, is that from your childhood? Did you do
that? Yeah, the wasps was. We did go hunting wasps. Right.
So when times were less involved with electronics and sugary sweets and the kinds of stuff we have access to today, it sounds like in your childhood, children were very inventive with what they tangibly did in the world.
Yeah, and very much with what was found, kind of found objects.
And you've brought that into your work with the children of today, and I just really love hearing that. So
Representational toys at all. Everything we do is non-representational. Uh-huh.
Oh, that's a good, interesting way to say that. So we have just a few minutes left, and I'd love to hear what you're up to now in your writing life.
I'm writing a book about Texas.
A Texas?
Yes, I am. My husband is from Texas, and I've been hearing Texas yarns for the past 20 years. So I'm trying to sort of weave them into something that involves the drama of the Texas-Mexico border and the culture clash down there between the very harsh West Texas pioneer culture and the Norteño culture of northern Mexico.
Wow. So it sounds to me like you're going to extend what you were able to do about culture and clashing and its impact on people from a situation you knew from your own growing up to a situation that you're exploring now because of your husband and, I'm imagining, some research.
Wow. Thank you. That's very insightful.
Well, it's one of the things I really love about listening to writers talk about their work is how they hone skills with, write what you know, and then have those skills and start exploring a larger world. And I look forward to reading what this book has to tell me when it comes out. And before we leave, I just want to mention any website information you might have. Your book is out from Fuse, F-U-Z-E, Publishing, which has a website at fuse.com. Do you have a website as well?
I have a Facebook page, but I mainly work through Fuse.
Okay, so they would find, any listener who wanted to would find you by going to the Fuse website.
Yes, that's the best website.
Okay, thank you. Anything else you want to tell us about how to read more about your work?
Well, the new book is going to be called Deep in the Heart, which tickles me.
Okay, yeah. do you think you'll publish with Fuse again, or should we be?
I hope so.
Oh, good.
They're a wonderful press.
Uh-huh. Excellent.
They're an excellent press.
If we become regular visitors to the press, we'll come across your book as soon as it's out.
It's been a wonderful interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thanks for bringing me back to my own growing up as well as to London when you lived there. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
You have been listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. For more of Sheila's interviews, please go to Sheila's website, writingitreal.com/audio. In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Announcer is Kurt Vanderslice.